Time again for another political rewind on a gloomy, gloomy day in the state of Georgia. Lots of rain, clouds. It's still kind of dark where I'm broadcasting from right now. And the weather's continue this way, apparently, for the next couple of days. But I'm no weatherman. I'm no meteorologist. I'm here to talk politics. And I have just the panel to do that today, starting with Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tamar, you took a little vacation and are back at work again, and we're so glad to have you back on the show today.
Thanks, Bill. Spent the week in Arizona getting a little sunshine. This gloomy weather isn't the best motivation to get back into it, but I'm excited to be back.
I understand that. Riley Bunch, who is a public policy reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, is back with us. Riley, you said before the show, you've been counting. This is your 20th appearance on Political Rewind. That's great. You've got a long way to go to catch up with these others, though.
I was just going to say I don't really have much on Tamar and Alan, but thanks for keep having me back.
We're glad to have you here. And Alan Abramowitz, emeritus professor of political science at Emory University. Alan, a long career at Emory, which continues with your emeritus status, but you're essentially beginning a well-deserved sort of retirement, I think it's fair to say, right?
That's right, sort of.
Okay. Well, we're glad you're here today. And a little later in the show, we're going to talk about a new piece that you've just published in Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball about white voters and how they're looking at Democrats these days. I was really fascinated by that. But Tamar, I'd really like to start today with this Herschel Walker interview with Glenn Beck. And to some extent, one of the reasons I want to talk about it is I thought, in a way, it deserved more attention than it got at the time. Now, we know Glenn Beck is a very conservative analyst. He's a big fan of Herschel Walker. He was essentially, he was wearing a Run Herschel button when he did the interview. And Tamar, he asked Herschel about accusations of domestic abuse, about his mental health problems. And I want to play, I'm going to play about a minute of it and then ask you all whether you, how you felt about what seemed to be a sort of a shrugging off of a very serious issue. Let's listen.
You have been on my podcast before, and we talked about mental struggles, mental illness that you have struggled with, the different things that you've gone through. You're truly, I think, a remarkable success story on being able to weather all of those storms. CNN is now coming out and saying that, I don't know, there was domestic violence in your past, and they say you won't address any of this stuff.
Well, you know, I've already addressed all of that stuff, and if they can see, Herschel Walker has never been arrested by a police officer, never been in a police station for anything. And I've told them I've addressed it all, and until they can educate themselves and maybe buy my book and read it and stuff and not make things up. And I don't talk to them because I'm not going to let them take my eyes off the ball. I'm here to represent the state of Georgia, here to represent the United States Senate, not to go into these gotcha questions or them trying to educate themselves or trying to be funny, because right now you're going to take mental health back. I brought it so far today because I've been doing this for about 15 years, and what they've done is taken mental health and made it like a game.
So, Tamar, he has talked about his mental health issues quite a bit. One of the things that I was struck by, though, was the sort of shrugging off in the way in which Glenn Beck asked question. Oh, I don't know, accusations of domestic violence. Isn't this a subject that Herschel Walker is going to have to talk about much more directly in his campaign ahead?
I would think so. This is a man who's running to represent 10 million Georgians in the U.S. Senate, and it comes with the vetting of being a candidate. I half agree with him in that I think the media sometimes can be really bad when it comes to talking about really sensitive issues like mental health. We've really bungled a lot of stories in the past when it comes to really sensitive issues like that. At the same time, it is our job to ask those questions and to keep asking those questions on behalf of the voters. That is our job, and that is our role in democracy. What I'm curious to see is whether this is going to be his strategy in the long term. You see a lot of Republican candidates now who are kind of taking that Trumpy position of not wanting to talk to anybody in the mainstream media. Is this going to be his strategy for the long term, only going on shows like Glenn Beck or Sean Hannity, or will he start making himself available to the mainstream media, especially if he makes it past a primary and is going to have to face the entire electorate? I think he will need to start answering those questions. So far, he hasn't acted like a traditional candidate. His event in Perry with former President Trump was his first time in kind of a more traditional campaign setting. And I'm curious to see if this is the strategy going forward.
Alan?
Well, I think he's going to be asked those questions, certainly. And I think particularly the allegations of domestic violence, which is something that is a little bit different. It's not just a matter of dealing with mental health issues. And I don't know that just saying, well, I was never arrested, is necessarily going to satisfy reporters. But I think that Tamar is absolutely right. I think the strategy going forward is going to be to try to avoid having to answer questions from reporters, from the mainstream media outlets, and to primarily talk to or do interviews with more friendly outlets, you know, with conservative pundits, and where he knows that, you know, he'll get softball questions and where he won't be pressed for answers. Eventually, especially if there are debates in a general election campaign, though, I think that he may be forced to come up with a more complete explanation, or somewhat more satisfying explanation for what happened.
Yeah, Riley, I want to again focus on this notion of dismissing in such a cavalier, it sounded to me like, way, this question about women who have accused him of violence against them. And I wonder, is he so famous? Is he so beloved by University of Georgia football fans that he will be able to, that they outweigh something as serious as domestic violence charges? I can't imagine that, but we have no way of knowing.
Well, I mean, I think it's also important to look at how the host asked the question, right? He said CNN is just bringing up these accusations, and that's not true. You know, we've known this. The AJC has done extensive reporting on this. But his reaction was, hey, go read my previously already written and edited responses in my book, right? Mm-hmm. So he's playing, like Tamar said, the classic Republican victim of the media card. And that is what he's running on, is this kind of hometown hero approach, right? He's playing to the things that people love about him. So if he can stay as far as he can away from these terrible accusations, it will be better for him.
So, you know, Alan, I thought we'd talk about this later in the show, but it strikes me this might be a good time to actually talk about the latest research that you published in Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, because you asked the question that's certainly going to have an impact on our race next year here, when Raphael Warnock faces off against a Republican candidate, all of whom are men, and maybe Herschel Walker. And the question you asked was, is there any way that the Democratic Party can win back the white working class voters who have abandoned them in elections over the past years? And you talk about what you decided about that in terms of the data that you crunched to get to your conclusion.
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that this has been the result of a very long-term trend in American politics, where we've seen a reversal of the traditional class divide between the parties among white voters, where if you go back to the New Deal and post-New Deal era, and as recently as the 1970s and 80s even, non-college whites were an important component of the Democratic electoral coalition, and white college graduates, on the other hand, were pretty solidly Republican in their voting tendencies. Now what we've seen is that has completely flipped. And there's this question that's constantly being debated among a Democratic strategist and some academics about, you know, what do the Democrats have to do to win back the support of white working class voters? And can they win them back? My conclusion is that it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to do that. That this alienation of non-college white voters from the Democratic Party, it goes very deep. It's not just based on one or two issues. It's not just based on cultural issues. It goes across the board. They find themselves on the opposite side of the Democratic Party on virtually all the major issues facing the country. And underlying that, in turn, is a sense of racial grievance that is very widespread among these non-college white voters. So there's a very small group of swing voters there among this group. Who are movable one way or the other. Joe Biden did win back a small a number of them, so he did slightly better. But in terms of any big shifts, I don't think we're going to see that. And some of the things that are being advocated as ways for Democrats to appeal to white working class voters, such as downplaying their support for LGBT rights, for example, would be likely to alienate the very college-educated white voters who have been moving in their direction in recent years. And who, by the way, played a crucial role in the victories that Democrats gained in the 2020 presidential election and then in the 2021 runoff elections in Georgia.
Yeah, Tamar, one of the things that I think Alan concluded here that's a warning sign for Democrats, he says Democratic leaders who have been trying to win back support of white working class voters who've been voting Republican in recent years have been trying to appeal to them through their economic interests or shifting to the right on issues like immigration and gay rights. And they're not going to get very far the way that Alan sees this. So, I mean, as we approach 2022, you've got to wonder whether or not these white working class voters are just, whether there's much reason, and Alan questions it too, that Democrats, have they just lost this group?
Yeah, and there's two things that kind of come to mind as Alan kind of summarized his report. The first is the nominating fight in 2020 on the Democratic side, the sprawling field that we did have, where you had a lot of people saying maybe Joe Biden is the right kind of guy to appeal to a lot of those, you know, white working class folks, you know, talk about his working class roots in Pennsylvania, kitchen table issues, that sort of thing. And that was the argument that was used to kind of rally the troops around him, that a more liberal nominee could alienate a lot of those voters. And, you know, Alan was right. It was enough to win over just enough, but it wasn't such a substantial change from 2016. What'll be interesting to see is kind of looking ahead to 2022 in Georgia. You know, Stacey Abrams kind of set the model in 2018 by proving that you could run as an unapologetic liberal in Georgia and do far better than a lot of those white candidates who had been kind of pushing toward the middle for the Democrats all those years and not doing much better than 45% of the electorate. So it's a strategy that has already started happening a lot in Georgia, and one that Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff only continued last year in the runoff, or sorry, earlier this year.
Yeah,
in the
runoff. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you at the end there, Tamar. You know, Riley, I said this frequently and during that 2018 election campaign, that first in the primaries, when Stacey Abrams did point the way for a Democratic Party of Georgia that could take on more liberal positions and hope to win an election, she defied years of conventional thinking in Georgia that it was yellow dog Democrats who somehow the Democratic Party had to get back into the fold. The Roy Barnes approach to politics. And in fact, back then, Roy Barnes, Buddy Darden, and others who believed in that yellow dog white rural Democratic coalition, in fact, backed Stacey Evans for a governor rather than Stacey Abrams. This is all my long way of saying that Tamar makes an excellent point. Stacey Abrams said, no, no, no. There's a new day in Georgia, and we can capitalize on it. But it really isn't among those white working class voters that Alan's talking about.
Well, I mean, I think that 2018 election and then as well as the Senate, two Senate seats this year, it showed that there are not moderate, there's not swing voters anymore, right? You know, the issues have become so polarized. It's one side or the other. And you're right. Democrats have learned that they can get away with that in Georgia. They can still win with these extreme policies. And I think going back to more of a national perspective of can Democrats win this group of voters back, I think if you layer over the policy decisions they've had to make during the pandemic or they've leaned toward making in the pandemic, you have mask mandates, shutdowns, things like that, I think that pushes that demographic of voters even further away, right? So any kind of gains they've had trying to win back those voters have substantially fallen backwards during the pandemic.
Ellen?
Yeah, I think that what Stacey Abrams' campaign showed and then the Biden campaign and the Warnock and Ossoff campaigns in the runoff election is that the Georgia it highlighted the ways that the Georgia electorate has changed over time. So one of the reasons Democrats, one of the key reasons that Abrams outperformed these earlier Democratic candidates and then Biden, Warnock, and Ossoff were able to finally break through is because of the increasing non-white share of the Georgia electorate and because of the increasing white share of college-educated voters among whites, particularly in metro Atlanta, where we saw big gains from the Democrats in 2020 and 2021. So it's a different electorate, and that's the key to understanding what's going to happen in 2022 as well. One thing we can predict with a high degree of confidence is that the voting patterns in 2022 in the elections for governor and in the U.S. Senate election are going to be very, very similar to the ones that we saw in 2020 and 2021. You're going to see the very, very similar coalitions. You're going to see very, very similar voting patterns across the different regions of the state. And the final outcome is probably going to be decided by a very narrow margin, you know, one way or the other, depending on which party does a better job of mobilizing its voters and appealing to the very small group of swing voters, you know, who, although small, I still would say, they still can be important because the elections are so close.
Yeah.
I mostly agree with what Alan said, with one big exception and one big kind of variable. What's so different about 2022 is that you still have somebody as powerful as former President Trump out there using every chance he can to crap on Brian Kemp. And so I think, would he be a more kind of conventional former president and stay out of politics or not crap on Republican politicians who are running for re-election, I would agree with Alan that it would be kind of about the same. But that's going to be the big variable this year. How much is Trump's criticism of Brian Kemp at every turn? How much is that going to sour Republican voters? Are there going to be Republican voters who sit out entirely in November 2022? Are there going to be ones who just skip the gubernatorial race on the ballot and then just start going from lieutenant governor on down? Will there be a Trumpier candidate who can challenge Brian Kemp in the primary? So far, we're not seeing that. So I think that's going to be a huge variable and one that Kemp's team has got to be sweating at this moment.
Yeah, you know, Riley, that makes complete sense. On one hand, I suppose if you're certainly if you're Brian Kemp, you've got to be glad that no serious and maybe that's unfair to Vernon Jones, but most people don't see him as a particularly serious challenger to Brian Kemp. That nobody has emerged at this point to challenge him. He is likely to be the nominee, but Tamar's point is well made. What happens in November if Trump won't stop attacking him? Will his base turn out? Will the Republican base turn out for Brian Kemp?
Well, I think that's the biggest concern, right? You know, we know Kemp is going to be successful in the primary, but if Donald Trump continues to come as he did in Perry and push back and push back and push him down and push Stacey Abrams ahead of Kemp. You know, that quote that he said Stacey Abrams was going to be a better governor than Kemp. That does that keep Republicans from the polls? And I think we've also seen very small but steady, you know, rebuke of Kemp in the county GOP parties. You know, we saw Cobb County censor him on the basis of illegal immigration, which was kind of weird, but it's just this internal fighting. And are Georgia Republicans going to be able to get people to back their incumbent? I don't know.
Ellen?
Well, that is the big question. And assuming that Trump, you know, continues, and there's no reason to think that he's going to change, you know, my hunch is that in the end, Republican voters in Georgia will rally behind Kemp. I think he's done enough. And clearly, he's been very concerned about making sure that he does things to try to win back the support or keep the support of the Republican base. And that's why we've seen him, you know, adopt certain policies on, you know, on opposing mandate, vaccine and mask mandates, and taking very, you know, conservative positions on other issues to appeal to these voters. And that's why I think you're not seeing a strong challenger in the Republican primary. You're not seeing a serious challenger. I don't think you will. And in the end, I don't think Trump is going to be have as big an impact there as a lot of people are suspecting, even though he remains
Ellen,
very popular with the base.
I apologize. As long as the ball is in your court, and I'd love everybody to weigh in on this eventually, to what extent is President Biden's approval rating right now, which is dropping dramatically? I mean, he's essentially at 45% right now, which is where Trump was at the same point in his presidency. But as Henry Olson, conservative columnist in the Washington Post, made clear today, among independents, he's about as unpopular as Trump was in this. He's a little ahead of Trump in terms of overall popularity, but among independents, he's no better than Trump. So the question is, number one, how important is the president's approval rating these days when all races are nationalized in next year's Georgia elections? And how important is the Biden agenda, the ability of Democrats to pass that agenda, to what happens in Georgia next year? Your thoughts on that, Alan?
Well, I think it matters. Certainly, I think the Democrats would much rather be running with a Joe Biden approval rating up in, above 50% than below 50%. It has fallen some, no question, although I'm not sure I'd agree with the dramatic part of that statement. If you think about where he was in the low 50s, and now he's in the mid-40s or something like that. There's still time for him to, you know, bump that back up again. I think you're likely to see his, especially if the Democrats are able to pass these key elements of the agenda, I think you'll see the approval rating improve somewhat among Democrats and among independents who lean Democratic. When you talk about independents, what I would say in response to Henry Olson's comment, column, is that you can't look at independents as a single sort of undifferentiated group. That they're divided into those who lean towards the Democrats and Republicans, and then a smaller group in the middle who don't really lean one way or the other. I think Biden can get support back, at least among the independents who lean towards the Democratic Party, if he can get that agenda enacted. But I look at my indicator I look at is not presidential approval so much as this, what's called the generic ballot. And it's a more direct measure of how voters are feeling about the upcoming congressional elections. Now, when we look at that, and there aren't many polls asking about that, but when we look at those that have been asked, where it's been asked recently, it shows the Democrats still with a modest advantage. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to hold on to their majority in the House and Senate, but I think there's nothing that I've seen yet so far that necessarily predicts anything like what we saw, you know, in 2010.
I think that
Riley, and then Tamar.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Alan on this one. I feel like it's early, right? He has the time to win back support, but it would still be unwise for Democrats not to be concerned. Biden has made a few missteps so far in office that has really turned away and upset minority voters, especially that are making such a huge impact on Georgia elections, how he handled Afghanistan, how he's handling the situation at the border. I think that, you know, he has time to improve, but like I said, that he should be on his toes a little bit.
Tamar, I'll give you the last word before our break.
Sure. I think the real impact on you know, of Biden's approval rating. And I agree with Riley and Alan. It's a little early. I'd be more curious to see what things look like closer to the primary and the general election. Right now, all these polls are a snapshot in time, and we're more than a year away from any date of consequence. But I think the real risk lies with the House majority that Nancy Pelosi is clinging to with about 3 votes. And that's where you always see in midterm election years, where the party that holds the White House and the majority is often the party that suffers traditionally. So I think that's where the Lucy McBaths and the Carolyn Bordeaux of the world have to worry, especially, with redistricting. But also, you know, Raphael Warnock is one that has to worry because Republicans are tying every single thing Joe Biden does to him. I think it'll matter a little bit less in these state level races, especially when it comes to governor.
Okay. Thank you for that. I've got to get to a break. I do want to say I was not suggesting that we are locked in to a situation that will prevail through 2022. I was asking whether the dynamics at play here, how much impact they could have as we move forward through 2022. And I appreciate all of your observations about that. Let's get to our first break of Political Rewind for today. We'll be back with more in just a moment. GPB's Riley Bunch, the AJC's Tamar Hallerman, and Emory University Emeritus Professor Alan Abramowitz are with us today. Riley, I do want to spend a couple minutes on a report that you published at GPB. It's been a week now, but we haven't seen you since it happened. You wrote a really compelling and troubling piece about abuse toward healthcare workers who are already overwhelmed with COVID in hospitals all over the state of Georgia, in some cases harassment, in some cases actual physical violence. Tell us just a little, and it had great impact. I mean, I was able to watch and see how people reacted to it. Tell us a little bit more about what you learned.
Well, I appreciate you bringing it back up on the show today. I know it's been a year in news cycle since that story came out, but hospitals across the state from north to south Georgia, they've been raising the alarm on a troubling spike in violence against their healthcare workers and staff in ER departments, in general departments, you know, against nurses. It could be anyone. It could be a technician. They're seeing, and this has been a long-term problem in healthcare, right? But they're seeing this spike for many different reasons. The hospitals are strained of resources. Healthcare staff are tired, and you know the retention rates are really bad. And also the COVID, you know, the crush of COVID on hospitals, the politicization, can't even say that word, of COVID, and the tensions in the room. So hospital staff, they're just getting pummeled by patients, by families, verbal abuse, physical abuse. And as state lawmakers actually are looking at this issue as in a study committee that the Senate is looking at right now, and they heard from hospitals last week. This is an issue they've tried to tackle before, but it hasn't gotten much better. And at this point, it's kind of a breaking point for hospitals right now.
Well, what are if you have a study committee looking at this in the legislature? The question is, what steps are they and what are they thinking they might do to address this?
Well, that's the big question, right? Yeah. So they have in the past, they've enhanced penalties for people that, had violent outbursts against hospital staff. But that hasn't necessarily changed the situation. We're not seeing things getting better. What hospitals were saying is they need more preventative training, right? De-escalation training, more funding for that. And also funding for staff. They are so low. Grady especially talked about how few security officers they have for their hospital that serves hundreds of thousands, right? So those are some of the things they brought up during the study committee. But another point is it's really hard to talk about these healthcare issues, these public policy issues. You know, we're seeing violence against our public health department, right? It's hard to talk about these issues right now when they're so politicized.
You talked to Kelsey Reed, who's the director of patient care at Phoebe Putney Hospital down in Albany, and which was hit so hard by COVID in the initial round of the virus and then hit again this year. And here's just a little of what she said to you about this.
We're in our profession for a reason. We're here to help people and to serve people, and that's our job, is to take care of people. So I think that often makes it really easy to just excuse the behavior. It's almost like we accept it as just being part of the job. But it should not be the norm. We just need a better process of how we handle it going forward.
You know, Tamara and Alan, by the way, we can post a link again to your story, which is available at gpb.org. So why don't we do that, Sam and Sarah, so people can read the entire story. But what I started to ask Tamara and Alan is these confrontational behaviors that in this case are all about hospital workers are being replicated in all parts of in other parts of our society. Mm-hmm. Teachers, educators are beginning to feel the same thing. Parents who are angry either because their kid is being forced to wear a mask or they're not don't have a mask mandate are being confronted in very emotional, in some cases, ways that are could be considered harassment. This is becoming an endemic problem across sectors of our lives, and it's incredibly troubling, Tamar.
And one thing I wonder is how much a response from the legislature can really, how much government can really help in a situation like this. Yes, I'm sure that safety officers at hospitals could help, but I think a lot of this stems from the heated rhetoric we see about every political issue on social media and on cable news. And to a certain extent, a lot of these politicians are kind of feeding into this, right? Because there's on one side or the other, everyone is so steamed all the time. And so I think that's part of it too. And I really do think it's a really compelling, heartbreaking story that Riley wrote. And just to put it into context, hospitals are already struggling to retain their workers right now after 18 months of a pandemic that has everyone burned out. People pulling all-nighters working these shifts in these hospitals, unending waves of people coming in. And so a lot of nurses and respiratory therapists are leaving. And so I'm sure this does not help the situation at all.
Alan?
Well, I would follow up on your point that, you know, we're not just seeing this with regard to healthcare workers and in hospitals. We're seeing it in many areas of life, many walks of life. I'm thinking now of what we've seen, for example, at some of the local school board meetings, where we're seeing these outbursts at times among parents, particularly, I would have to say, among those who are opposed to things like mask mandates. There's not a simple or easy solution to this. Clearly, COVID has really ramped up the sort of pressure here. But I do think that a large part of the blame for this goes to political leaders who have been deliberately inflaming the attention interfering in decisions of local governments, for example. And I think that's making it more difficult.
You know, Riley, forgive me for putting this in a personal context, but, I'm a child of the 60s. I was out there demonstrating against the war in Vietnam. I, like a lot of people my age, we were challenging institutions in fairly antagonistic ways, but the center held. Democracy prevailed. The country did not start to fall apart at that point. It looked like it might. Today, I worry about your generation. I worry about my grown children's generation and the lack of respect for institutions, the unraveling of democracy. That's a huge question and one I hope we can take up on Political Rewind at some point. But I do worry about what's happened to respect and people's ability to work together to solve problems.
Well, God, it is such a big question, but I think it goes back to it's politics. It's the time in politics that we're seeing right now, this divisiveness, this one side or the other. And I think, you know, being on the younger end of journalism, I don't remember a time I was covering politics when it wasn't like this, right? But I've talked to older journalists, been covering politics for decades, and they have never seen a time like this where journalists are distrusted, doctors are distrusted, scientists are distrusted. It's so extreme, and it'll be so hard to come back to. And to your point, for the generations growing up in this, this is all they've known.
All right. Well, I didn't mean to get all philosophical on y'all, but it's just a subject that I think is deserving of a lot more attention in the weeks and months ahead. Let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. We still have a lot of subjects I'd love to ask the panel about, and we'll do that after the final break of Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Tamar, Riley mentioned in our earlier conversation that Cobb County Republican Party has become the latest to censure Governor Brian Kemp, the Republican governor of the state of Georgia. They did it on the basis of his unwillingness or his inability to fight illegal immigration. I'm not quite clear on how much the governor of a state like Georgia that isn't along the Mexican border can do about it, but that's the tack they took.
Yeah, and one of many county Republican parties that have done the same. He's also gotten rebukes in Appling, Chattooga, DeKalb, Jasper, a whole bunch. So, and the move has caused a lot of division internally. We saw the former head of the Cobb GOP resign in opposition to that move, and he talked about how he saw it as counterproductive, especially as we're looking at primary season next year and trying to reelect Brian Kemp. So, as we were talking about at the top of the show, it is certainly a challenging time to be Brian Kemp. And how do you keep a party unified when you have a former commander in chief who is so actively and publicly attacking a Republican governor?
Yeah, Alan, Jason Shepard, the former GOP chair up in Cobb County, quit over this censure of Kemp. Mm-hmm. And he made the point that really we were talking about earlier. He said, how can the Republican Party of Cobb County censure the guy who they're eventually going to have to endorse in a general election campaign against whoever the Democrats, presumably Stacey Abrams, put up?
I think the Republicans across the country, not just here in Georgia, have a big problem heading into the midterm elections next year. You know, as we were saying earlier, normally in a midterm election year, the president's party, in this case, the Democrats, would be expected to lose seats in the House and Senate and in state legislatures. That's just the normal pattern of American politics. One of the reasons why I think there's some uncertainty about that heading into next year is that we have former President Trump, who is stirring the pot and who is intervening in Republican primaries, who is endorsing candidates, and in some cases candidates challenging longtime Republican incumbents like Liz Cheney in Wyoming, and some of the candidates that he's endorsing here, I think are ones who are coming from the far right wing of the Republican Party. Somebody like Jody Heiss here in Georgia, who he has endorsed for Secretary of State, who's challenging incumbent Brad Raffensperger. If Jody Heiss is successful in defeating Brad Raffensperger in that primary, then I think that very much puts that seat at risk for Republicans. If Raffensperger is the incumbent is running, they probably have a pretty good chance of holding that seat. But if it's Jody Heiss, then I think that you're just opening things up and giving the Democrats a real opportunity to win that seat. And that's what we're kind of seeing in a number of races around the country. So I think the very divisive presence of President Trump and some of his allies in these primary contests across the country is a source of really deep concern for Republicans right now.
In 2018, Brian Kemp edged out Stacey Abrams by only about 55,000 votes. That was an incredibly tight margin. And if that matchup is going to happen again next year, it makes me wonder how tight is it going to be, and how much can Donald Trump publicly attacking Brian Kemp, how much does that eat into that margin? We saw the danger of that in January as Trump was railing against the results of the 2020 election and not kind of actively doing more to help David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. That was enough for them to lose their races. Is that something we're going to see again in 2022 with Brian Kemp? If just enough Republican voters sit out of that general election race, is that going to be enough for Stacey Abrams to win? It's very possible.
I think Tamar hit the nail on the head, right? You know, these local groups and their communities, these are the grassroots voters that Republicans so desperately need to turn out to the polls right now. It may seem that there's, you know, a handful of counties that have censured Governor Brian Kemp, Brad Raffensperger, these Republican officials, but they add up, right? And with margins so narrow, if these voters, these grassroots voters who are diehard to the Republican Party are not showing up, that's a concern for Republicans.
All right. We will be talking about that for a long, long time to come, obviously, as the 2022 election cycle continues moving forward. But let me change the subject and go back, really. We keep talking about Donald Trump's challenge of the 2020 election in Georgia, and there's all this news that spins off from that and continues to do so. The latest is, as we know, there are a group of pro-Trump advocates who have been in court trying to get a judgment that Fulton County's absentee ballots need to be examined more closely. The judge has put off a final ruling on that, Brian Amaro, a Superior Court judge. But now there's a new approach that group has taken, Riley. Now they are asking the judge, there's five members of the Fulton County Election Board, as of last year, three Democrats, two Republicans. Now, the group that's challenging the absentee votes is asking the judge to dismiss the Democrats so that there are only Republican members of that board, and then the group would turn to the Republican members of the board, who would more than gladly give them what they're asking for. Now, there's very little chance that a judge is going to allow this, but it just shows the lengths that they're willing to go to try to get this to happen.
Well, it's definitely a very interesting strategy that I have not seen before. When I read that story in the AJC, I thought I read the first graph wrong. You know, I had to go back and read it a couple times. They're only suing the Republicans. What? But, it's not incorrect to think that if they did have these Democrats dismissed, that it would be more of a lenient case for them. And they might actually, well, it would be hard to see the judge allow this, but, you know, they might actually get their review in that way. So I think it's an interesting effort. I'll see how it plays out in court, though.
Alan, here we go again. It's just another unwinding of institutions.
Well, it's really remarkable. I mean, I'm really amazed that this case has gotten as far as it has, to tell you the truth. And now we see the results of this recount in Arizona. Where Republicans challenged the vote in Maricopa County, right? They got the ballots. They got their people in there to recount them, the cyber ninjas. The cyber ninjas recounted the ballots and concluded that there was a difference in the outcome. Joe Biden won by more than what the original count showed, slightly more. And yet in the aftermath of that, here we go again. Here in Georgia, and this is happening in a number of other states as well, even in Texas, we're seeing a challenge as well, where Donald Trump won pretty easily. Republicans nevertheless want to recount ballots. And all of this is being stimulated, of course, by the former president himself and some of his political allies. This determination to relitigate the 2020 election, and we're seeing that whenever Trump shows up for a rally, that's what he wants to talk about. He doesn't want to talk about the future of the Republican Party, about the candidates who will be running in the midterm elections, about what policies the Republicans should pursue in the future. He wants to go back and relitigate the 2020 election, and I think it's very risky. This is very dangerous. territory. I think in the end, this suit is going to be thrown out for sure. And this latest iteration of it is, you don't have to be a legal expert, I think, to see this as totally absurd. But it's just another indication of just how far we're seeing some Republican activists and party leaders willing to go to down the rabbit hole with the former president.
Meanwhile, Tamara, the Brookings Institution, which is a left-leaning think tank, and which has been where they've been keeping careful track of all these election challenges for months and months now, they've been doing a major project around that. Their legal analysts have now issued a report which says that Fannie Willis, the Fulton County DA, who is still investigating whether to bring criminal charges potentially against Donald Trump for interfering with the election, their reporting and their analysis suggests that Trump really is vulnerable to the possibility of being charged in this matter. And they issued a supplemental report after the rally in Perryville a couple of weeks ago because they say that some of the comments Trump made there add fuel to the fire and give the Fulton County DA more to work with.
Yeah, in their report, they conclude that Trump is at, quote, a substantial risk of possible state charges predicated on multiple crimes. And they go on to list a whole bunch, including criminal solicitation to commit election fraud, intentional interference with performance of election duties, conspiracy to commit election fraud, racketeering, all sorts of things. The report also goes into possible legal defenses that Trump and his team might use. And in general, these authors conclude that they don't think Trump has much of a defense. Of course, should be taken with a grain of salt, but certainly interesting as we wait to hear more from Fannie Willis's office. It's been about 7 months since she sent letters to Brian Kemp, Chris Carr, all of our top Republican state officials, urging them to preserve documents. We know that her attorneys have gone in front of a grand jury to solicit documents and to get subpoenas for documents and interviews with people. We know they've talked to people in Brad Raffensperger's office. They've hired the state's top expert on racketeering. But that's sort of all we know at the moment. And we're kind of expecting for things to heat up in the months ahead.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch how that proceeds. And if they should decide to indict, the explosion would be, I think, so powerful that it would be really something to watch unfold. Let me, one last quick subject before we have to leave today. Riley, the State Ethics Board has raised the ceiling for what candidates can, how much money a candidate can raise for elections in the state of Georgia. Two questions about that. Well, not a question. I didn't realize the ethics board had the power to do that unilaterally. Apparently they do. But do we really need to give candidates more money in the election cycles ahead? It just struck me as we don't need any more money, Riley.
Well, money in politics is never a fun subject, right? And I think that the board argued that they were raising this money due to inflation, right? Inflation of costs and things like that. But we're seeing Republicans, we've already seen Republicans open up channels for new funds for their candidates during legislative session. And I think that it kind of stems from a deep-rooted concern that campaigns, as Georgia gets so much national attention, these campaigns are raking in more and more cash. And if Governor Brian Kemp is up against Stacey Abrams, who is a money-making machine, you know, he's going to need all the help he can get, right? So I don't think it's surprising to see the State Ethics Commission do this ahead of such a tumultuous election that we're going to see.
Ellen, is obscene a word to use here?
Well, I think that was exactly right. I mean, I think that the reason we're seeing these efforts to allow candidates, and particularly incumbents, to bring in more money, particularly Republicans, is because they're feeling the pressure of heading into the midterm election cycle. Judging by what we've been seeing on the airwaves, I don't think there's any shortage of money right now. I judge it by what we saw in 2020 and 2021, when the airwaves were literally saturated with political advertisements. I mean, how are they going to use this additional money? There is a diminishing return on campaign spending. And when you look at it, now we're talking about tens of millions of dollars being spent on these, literally tens of millions being spent on these statewide races, far, far more than in the past. But I think you have to question, how effective is this additional spending even going to be when the airwaves are already saturated and voters are already lined up? You know, voters, people, the vast majority are already lined up. And I'm very skeptical that it's going to end up making much difference one way or the other.
We're out of time. Alan Abramowitz gets the last word on today's show. Alan, thank you so much. It was great to have you here. Tamar Hallerman, we always love Tuesdays when you're with us. And Riley Bunch, thank you for being here for today's show. That's it for Political Rewind today. Sarah Callis, Sam Burmistaus, thank you for your work on the show today. We're back, of course, with a new show tomorrow. And as I close, I'd like to say, please take care, stay healthy, wear your mask when you're around people, especially indoors, and go get a flu shot, since I know you're already vaccinated against COVID. Mm-hmm. See you all tomorrow.